Would you please go on the record with the American people? Did you sexually assault Tara Reid?
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened. And it didn't. It never happened.
Do you remember her? Do you remember any types of complaints that she might have made?
I don't remember any type of complaint she may have made. It was 27 years ago. And I don't remember, nor does anyone else that I'm aware of. And the fact is that I don't remember. I don't remember any complaint ever having been made.
That was presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden responding to sexual assault allegations last week as posed to him by MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Good morning, friends.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy May the 4th. And may the 4th be with you all.
I'm with it. Screw it. Let's have our secular holidays for once. The last several times we have convened this August gathering of humans, we've started it with a litany of grim COVID-19 statistics. We're not going to do that today because of the aforementioned audio clip, but we will bury some of those numbers in the back half of the show. But wanted to address a story that's been kind of submerged within the media ecosystem until this past week, which are sexual assault allegations against Joe Biden that appear to my untrained eye to be a somewhat more evidentiary based than the ones levied against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh from last fall or whenever that happened. Tara Reid, who worked in Joe Biden's Senate office in the 1990s, alleged in an interview with Katie Halper in March of this year that Biden in 1993 pinned her up against the wall, sexually assaulted her with his fingers. Sorry for that. Then essentially told her to walk it off. Took several weeks after for elite media institutions to publicly note and begin investigating that allegation. Some of what they found are that people remembering contemporaneously from back then that she did tell that story. The case and the reaction to it have generated a bunch of discussion, a lot of it about political and journalistic hypocrisy. And we will certainly get into that aspect of it. But I wanted to start off first, and there's no way I was going to address this to any other person on this podcast.
All right.
Catherine.
Yeah.
No, I want to start with the allegation itself. Like, what would it be like if we actually talked about the thing rather than the reaction to the thing? So does the allegation to you sound credible or plausible or whatever, mandible to you? And if so, what do you think should be done about it, either legally or politically, if anything?
The part that gets me is the fact that it was 27 years ago, which is something that Biden has chosen to emphasize in the rest of that interview. From the clip that we played, he says over and over, it was 27 years ago, it was 27 years ago, it was 27 years ago, which, you know, charitably, you can interpret that as he's saying, it's hard for me to remember because it was 27 years ago. But I think that there's also an attempt to suggest that if something like that happened, but it was a really, really long time ago, that makes it less bad or less important or less relevant. And at the very least, during the Kavanaugh hearings, all right-thinking, politically correct people agreed that that was not an appropriate analysis, right? I mean, over and over and over, we came back to, it doesn't matter how young he was, it doesn't matter how long ago it was, the kind of person who would do this kind of thing is that kind of person forever. And so
that's right. He was 17, right?
He was 17 or 18 at the time. And
Joe Biden was like 65.
Because 27 years ago, Joe Biden was still,
he was in his second century,
a senior citizen somehow. And, you know, I actually am a little bit of two minds about that. Like my initial impulse is to be like, no, you know, sexual assault is sexual assault. It doesn't matter when it happened. But I do think the thing that Kavanaugh himself really couldn't effectively say, and that Biden has no option to say at this point because of how he positioned himself during the Kavanaugh hearings, which is that the norms and standards and the sense of what is and isn't appropriate really have changed dramatically for the better in that time. Now, if he did what he is accused of doing, there are no norms and standards even 27 years ago that allow that kind of behavior. But I do think it is one of the more difficult parts of this discussion is talking about the fact that we used to let men like Biden get away with a lot more garbage than we do now. And that's, as I say, been an evolution for the good, but it puts everyone in a difficult position when they talk about behavior that was a long time ago. So I do think the 27 years ago point is important, but I think we're dodging half of why it's important because it's so hard to talk about.
I was 24 years old 27 years ago. And when you're younger and fresher out of college, you might have more kind of politicized ideas about things. But Nick, you were also a young adult back then. I don't recall that being an okay push up against the wall and like unwanted hand. That wasn't in play as something that was okay back then. So let me pose the question to you, Nick. Basically, same one. Does it sound credible? If so, what is to be done about such a thing now?
Well, I mean, I think we're finally getting to the question, which is that the charge should be investigated and worked through, in some kind of public venue. It's going to be the press. It's almost certainly not going to be any kind of official thing. There's no confirmation hearing or anything like that. A big part of this story, I think, early on was simply the refusal by the mainstream media, by the legacy media, to even acknowledge it. Because Biden, after these claims first surfaced, Biden was on a ton of talk shows and things like that. And, nobody asked him about it. And that, that rankled a lot of people. And I think particularly compared to the Kavanaugh situation, I think we're at a place now where the claim is being vetted and also Biden's stance on this kind of stuff is being discussed. To me, the 27 years ago, Catherine, the way I read that was partly, distancing it, but also that why haven't there been more claims like it, coming out since then? Biden is in a particularly weird position, too, because earlier last year or a couple months ago, he semi-apologized for being handsy and hair sniffing and things like that, which is weird and serious, but it's nothing like what we're talking about here.
So
in a way, and then in the past, he said, believe women.
To have a barber license for what he was doing with women's hair, right?
Yeah, no, it's really messed up. It's messed up. And this charge is extremely serious. It's arguably more serious than anything, that was at all credible against Kavanaugh. I think we're getting to a good place, and I think we may be getting to a better place in terms of we're getting to a good place where this stuff is being discussed openly. And then also we're getting to a better place where now because the people who were all in on saying anything that Kavanaugh did that smacked of anything bad when he was, 30 years ago, he's disqualified. Now they're going to be a little bit more circumspect and we'll have a better discussion in the same way that between the time of Clarence Thomas and Bill Clinton, we started to have a more adult conversation about what counts as harassment, what counts as,
it's weird though, because shouldn't we have already had that conversation like 10
Absolutely.
Times over vis-a-vis Bill Clinton, right? I mean, this is...
Or Donald Trump.
Right.
But
in particular, the dynamic of increasing awareness of the seriousness of sexual assault and sexual harassment paired with the sort of motivated partisan thinking. I mean, I am old enough, just barely, to remember how that went down with Clinton. And it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing for Democrats at the time. And it's weird to me that we're doing it again with Biden, with the same generation of Democratic leader. Now, again, I of course want to say Republicans have their own slightly different brand of hypocrisy and partisan motivated denials, of course, with respect to Donald Trump.
Yeah, because they're saying, Kavanaugh, that was a long time ago. He was a kid. It didn't matter. With Biden, no, it's like no matter what, it matters and he should step out of the race or something like that. I think in both cases, too, and this goes to the idea that it was a long time ago, is that, with Kavanaugh, one of the things that was most kind of curious about the pattern of behavior that was supposedly, you know, his in his character when he was in college or high school or whatever. He, by all accounts, was exemplary in terms of gender dynamics and fairness among sexes as a judge and whatnot. And you didn't hear anything in the interim that spoke to him being a true pervert or, you know, somebody who was that person he was accused of being many years ago. With Biden, it's a little bit more complicated because of his semi-apology and these claims by mostly Bernie Sanders supporting women when it looked like Sanders could get the claim. But I these things never work out well, and they never proceed, Catherine, the way that they should. But I think we are getting to a better place.
The Joe Biden element of the Brett Kavanaugh's, you know, good track record is, right, he authored the Violence Against Women Act. He's the leading guy there. Peter, one thing that we talked about on this podcast during the Kavanaugh period was that it's important to have a sense of a broader sense of not just a strict legalistic sense of the notion of due process, and that we should think through how, and this is something that Robbie Suave has written about a ton on our side, as have many other people. We should think through how we work publicly through various accusations of sexual assault or lousy behavior in the past. How would you apply that thinking to just working through the allegation here? You know, again, removing the hypocrisy charge, the media charge, the political charge. Like, if we're giving Joe Biden due process, what does that look like? What does that mean now?
Well, in some sense, you know, a different way to think about that question is, how would Joe Biden suggest we do it? And in particular, how would Joe Biden of 2 years ago suggest we do it? And he had a standard in September 2018, during the Kavanaugh trial, told reporters, this is a quote, "For a woman to come forward in the glaring lights of focus nationally, you've got to start off with a presumption that at least the essence of what she's talking about is real, whether or not she forgets facts, whether or not it's been made worse or better over time." That's a standard. We could apply that standard. That is the standard that Joe Biden wanted applied when Brett Kavanaugh was being investigated. Biden also notably has taken the lead under President Obama in reinterpreting Title IX, a law that prohibits sex and gender-based inequality in schools. And he basically said that in universities, the Obama administration's theory here was, or sort of direction, was that universities should follow a set of norms and procedures that kind of end up making it just more likely for people who are accused of sexual misconduct, which is in virtually the vast majority of cases men, in many cases men of color, just make it sort of push it, their reinterpretation pushed it towards the assumption of guilt on the part of the person who was being accused. And so I think, you know, in some ways, the question here is how would Joe Biden think about the accusation that has been lobbed against him if it were against anyone else? And what is his record there? And it's just really notable to me that he has been, in some ways, I don't quite want to say an enemy of due process, but he has nudged it in a different direction, undermined kind of some of the essential features of due process, been a proponent of a system in which, at least on college campuses, where, yes, there is a real sexual assault problem that is significant, that requires attention from administrators and perhaps even from political leaders. But he has been a proponent of a system in which the accused are more likely to be found guilty, often without anything that we would call real substantive due process.
I think that's a good starting point for a conversation, and it's a real pie in Joe Biden's face. But I have to rush to say, I don't want to live in Joe Biden's world on virtually any policy issue. He was terrible.
So I'm not necessarily saying that that's a good standard. But if you are asking the question, how should we judge the accusation against Joe Biden? a good place to start, I think, is how would Joe Biden have judged it against anyone else? And it's not that that
I
is
agree.
The, that should be the universal standard. In fact, I think it shouldn't be. At the same time, it's worth starting there and saying, Joe Biden, you are running for president. You are the presumptive nominee for one of the two major parties. There's two people in the world who are reasonably likely to be president in January of next year. You are one of them. What is your record on this? If you think that a different standard should apply to you, why?
I think he actually explained that in the excellent Morning Joe interview session, or whatever you want to call it, with Mika Brzezinski, who was really tough. And, you know, she got a lot of praise for that. I think all of us were expecting her to be the worst interviewer, like to be, you know, powder puff softball interview deluxe. And it was really hard. And he said, you know, he believes all women, you know, as at a starting point, and that this particular accusation is false. What we should do as a society is learn from this and push it back into his face and his supporters' face, so that, you know, and I think Catherine was getting towards this, of the depoliticization of this type of stuff. But I don't think we get anywhere by, you know, working through this mostly, and Peter, I'm not saying you were necessarily saying this, by working through this in a partisan or an interested way. We have to move very quickly from the fact that this invalidates, or it really creates a lot of problems for the way Joe Biden and a lot of people who follow him have been talking about this stuff. Now let's have the real conversation that we need to be having, so that we don't completely, you know, just keep replicating this, because we all know that between now and the election, there's going to be a bunch of, you know, semi-credible new accusations against Donald Trump or whoever he picks as a running mate, because Mike Pence, you know, has been going around maskless in, you know, COVID research facilities or something like
Catherine, that. Like, to Nick's point, though, like, yeah, we need to get it out of politics, but we just can't, right? Like, that's the point. Yeah. This is, once you have a weapon, it's going to be weaponized. And I mean, I don't think it's an accident that this came up in March.
Isn't it already a weapon?
Your face. Just let it happen.
Or already weaponized.
Let it happen.
If it's a weapon.
That's the point. But like, yeah, aren't we in a kind of Mobius strip of badness when it comes to the politicization?
A Mobius strip of Escher paintings, man.
Yes. You get me. And so, like, how we can't step off of it. This is what we have. And so it does. I don't know how to form this into question. So maybe are you going to wear your shirt saying, "Don't blame me. I never vote for the rapist"?
Yeah, I am. I've got that shirt printed up. It's just waiting to be deployed. It's on the front.
It's a shame you're wearing it now, but nobody can see it.
On the front, it says, "Don't blame me. I didn't vote." And then on the back, it says, "For the rapist." It's a.
That's pretty good.
To me, the trick here is, as you say, like, I think at this point, you can assume almost any person in public life will have a sexual assault allegation lodged against them, at least for the foreseeable. Like, this is now just like a ritual that we do, particularly if they're a political figure, but probably even if they're not, to be honest. And, you know, I think this is where the question of media bias really does get more interesting. Like, I think we all understand now, okay, you know, there are certain cable news channels and certain writers and certain reporters who are going to hit the other guy with, you know, the least charitable interpretation of any remark that they make, who are going to go looking for stories that make Team Red or Team Blue look bad, depending on which side they're on. But this is something that we actually talk about internally here, is like our libertarianism and our priors, which are a little bit orthogonal to the rest of the world, sometimes help us see stories that other people can't see. And I think this is a really good example of that the New York Times, for instance, looked at this fact pattern about Biden and Tara Reid and those allegations, and made a bunch of coverage decisions based on their priors. And that is like the subtler part of media bias that people really don't appreciate, that whether something is a story at all. And the fact that they really wanted this to not be a story. And it's not crazy to say, listen, every person in public life has allegations against them. Some of those allegations aren't a story. But in this case, I think that was the wrong call, and it was because the priors were blinding. So I guess I'm thinking a lot about it as an editor. Like, how do we decide what stories to cover, knowing that we're in this kind of pool with people who are making motivated coverage decisions all the time? And at least one of the factors should be, if someone really, really wants a story to go away, maybe that's a reason for us to look more closely at it.
Oh, another way of looking at this, Peter Suderman, is like, okay, Biden's running for president, and I think we've all sort of nodded in the direction of this isn't going to be a legal finding. This is going to be more journalistic or public or whatever, the vetting of these charges. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the other guy running for president has some sexual assault allegations against him as well. Are we ever going to talk about it the same way that we just spent the last 20 minutes talking about Joe Biden? Because, like, we're not surprised anymore. We're the dog in the fire saying this is fine. Where's my coffee? How does that calibrated and how do you assess people dealing with that right now?
I don't think we're ever going to have the same conversation about Donald Trump that we're going to have about Joe Biden, because they're different people, because the accusations are different, because the media environment is not perfectly equal. And because Joe Biden, whatever else you think about him, has done a clearer and better job of responding to this accusation than Donald Trump did to any of the stuff that was lodged against him in the 2016 race. It's just impossible to imagine Donald Trump sitting relatively calmly, trying to answer relatively clearly, not always perfectly clearly, not always, certainly, like, there seemed to be some gaps in the memory, some long recall times in that Biden interview. But you can't imagine that happening with Donald Trump. Now, part of the reason that Joe Biden kind of is doing this is because he kind of has to, because of his own record on these issues. And there is simply something to the, I think it's unfortunate. I don't think this is good, but there is something to the sort of the notion that we have low expectations for Donald Trump. When the Access Hollywood tape came out, if you guys remember, there were a bunch of Republicans looked like they were going to turn on him. But what Trump sort of seemed to instinctively realized was, you know what? This is basically who I am. This is pretty much what people think about me. I'm just going to keep going. Say, you know what? I'm going to say it was locker room talk. That's how boys talk when they're alone. And we're going to just not worry about it. And he won the election. And Joe Biden can't do that, even though he's a little bit of a hair sniffer and a little bit of a shoulder massager. He is someone who has a record of saying that these types of accusations are serious, and therefore he has to go ahead and go through the motions and go through the process of taking this seriously. And that is going to create an imbalance. And The New York Times and CNN and The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal could all devote a full week to Trump's, where they could have Trump Sexual Assault Week and publish nothing but coverage of Donald Trump's sexual assault allegations.
Sounds like a prediction.
There are plenty of them. There, right? There are at least a dozen of them. There's stuff that's on record. I mean, the Access Hollywood tape is, I think it is not completely uncharitable to listen to that quote and see it as at least an admission of a kind of sexual assault. And you can have an argument about that, but like that is at least a not unreasonable reading of it. And so like you could do that, and it still wouldn't really change the imbalance in how we see these people and how they are going to be treated. And to be clear, the Republican establishment is absolutely not going to talk about Trump's stuff and is just going to blast Biden for this. The RNC has already been sending out just
wildly
jerky,
unself-aware
sort of, like,
press releases.
Yes, unself-aware, uncharitable press releases about this, that, you know, like making clear that they are going to make this an issue and going to try and pin this on Biden and not worry in any way about the very large sexual assaulter in the White House.
Can we talk real quick about...
That was about to be an elephant in the room, yeah, but it didn't come out that way.
It's an elephant in the room. Can we talk real quick about the fact that as I'm on the record in this podcast many times saying I'm hoping that a silver lining of our coronavirus episode is that people don't touch each other as much going forward? And like, will there be a second order effect, which is like... the remaining Bidens, like the remaining like hair sniffers and shoulder massagers, like do those people have they like can they be rehabituated to not do that after several months of not doing that? Like is that going to be an upside we can look forward to?
Or maybe it's they're building up a pent up.
It's going to be like the close talkers in New York.
Oh no, a pent up demand for shoulder massaging is giving me like.
I mean, I think hasn't much of that dissipated over the past 20 years, but certainly over the past couple of years because of Me Too.
Now, people like to touch people. It's horrible.
Let's, Nick, maybe transition here to the presidential candidate who is decidedly on record saying that he did not do anything untoward with his hands. Is there something, and before we get to Justin Amash and news about him, is there just something inherently corrupting about the way that a two-party system makes people essentially say, yeah, well, at least he's my rapist? Like, is there any way to get out of that? Like, literally.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a really strong question. And obviously, all of us at Reason, because Catherine put it orthogonal, I mean, we're outside of the two-party, you know, power matrix. This kind of stuff is just more reasons to get out of that, you know, to stay away from major party politics or to find yourself primarily in terms of being a Republican or a Democrat. I think we're seeing this right now, sure. And as Peter was saying, you know, the RNC is going to run with this as long as their chubby little legs can carry them. And, you know, the DNC was, you know, is going to come up with something new. You know, that'll be in a similar vein or something like that. Yeah, I think there is something inherently corrupting in politics where you start to, you know, I mean, and, you know, and you were referencing, Matt, you know, the Gene Kirkpatrick line of like, at least, you know, when we have a dictator or a murderer or a tyrant, at least he's our guy. You know, that's a profoundly disturbing statement, which very many people loved during the Cold War because it seemed to be really important, you know, that it's like, it's okay if Pinochet is killing a bunch of people in soccer stadiums because we hate soccer anyway. It's a communist sport.
That's true.
And it's only, you know, it's only 5,000 people or it's only 3,000 people. And he's not as bad as, you know, Castro, who, you know, and it's like that is the problem with politics. And we should always be fighting that ability to say, you know, it's like, okay, you get one free grope or you get 10 free murders because you're on our team. That's not a way to live.
So the big news in libertarian politics last week on Tuesday night, Justin Amash, congressman from Michigan, 5-term incumbent and a self-described libertarian independent, announced finally that he's running for president, seeking the Libertarian Party's nomination for the White House in 2020. That was supposed to happen, the decision that the party makes at the May 21st to May 25th nominating convention in Austin. That has now been, as of Saturday, postponed to sometime between now and July 15th. It's supposed to be decided on within 10 days of where the in-person convention will take place between now and July 15th. So everything's going fine.
That's every decision in my life I could describe exactly that way. Sometime between now and July 15th, I will do the thing. I'll let you know in 10 days whether or not I'm going to do the thing. Like, seriously.
Did the LP apply for stuff under the Paycheck Protection Program? Should they get a bailout as a small business?
They might finally. I mean, they would get so much more money than their annual thing. My suggestion to them, and I don't make many suggestions to the Libertarian Party, but you should schedule your convention if you're going to have it in person in Huntington Beach, California. That's a place where...
Who would know?
Anyways, Nick and I both interviewed the congressman last week, so I want to hear more, less from us and more from Suterpants and
from people who haven't directly talked to the candidate.
We're honored to be in your presence, Nick.
Suderman, what has struck you so far about Amash's messaging, the way that he's selling himself?
Amash is selling himself in a way that he often has, but more he's like making it explicit. He is rather than just doing it. And the way he is selling himself is as a process oriented constitutionalist. And this, I think, is very appealing to me as somebody who cares about the Constitution, but also really cares about political processes and norms and like making government work, it's well is one way to put it, but like effectively and sort of in a way that is sort of stable and can be and reproducible and is not going to just sort of cycle off into, you know, spin off into terrible outcomes. And so he's part of being a process-oriented constitutionalist is, of course, caring about the Constitution and the core fundamental protections of the Constitution and talking about that sort of thing. But he also, and I think this is really interesting and worth talking about, he cares a lot about character and he cares a lot about civility and decency, not just because Justin Amash appears to be like actually a civil and decent and nice person, but because he recognizes that character and civility and decency are part of the political process. So when he talks about Trump being a person of low character, a kind of a mean guy, a bad guy, he will just say Trump is a bad person, which I have written. So, you know, I agree with in many ways. He doesn't just mean that guy's a jerk and I don't like him and I don't like jerks. He doesn't not mean that. But what he's talking about is what he means is that Trump's attitude, all the ridiculous bluster and the name calling and his sort of inability to pay attention to anything for very long, his unwillingness to negotiate in good faith. What Amash means is that that affects policy outcomes for the worse. And so he is not just making a character argument that says, well, my opponent is bad. I don't like him. He's saying my opponent is the type of person who, when he operates within this system, he breaks the system down and produces worse outcomes for the Constitution, for policy, for the country in general. And I think that's a really important connection to make when you're going to talk about Trump's character and not liking him. And he, you know, I think it's actually interesting where he has said, he told, I believe, Politico's Tim Alberta, he basically said, I think Joe Biden appears to be a better person. And has made that explicit, not just saying, you know, and he's making these character judgments that are not just, well, they're both bad people. That's the other sort of thing that he's doing that's also interesting that we should talk about is talking about the similarities between the Democratic and the Republican Party, Democratic and Republican leadership, and the ways that the two parties actually conduct themselves as sort of mirror images of each other and are much closer to each other than people who are really invested in red team, blue team politics often seem to think.
So, Catherine, if Amash is running on a Peter Suderman pleasing process campaign, he should get at least 0.1% of the vote, right?
Yeah. I mean, as I've said many times before, I think it's pretty clear that my affection for a candidate is in direct inverse proportion to that candidate's chances of influencing the political process or electoral success. And so I love me some Justin Amash and therefore assume he's doomed. I have been enjoying in his Twitter feed, he's like really leaning into the idea of voting as an expressive act, which, you know, I've also talked about before. Like, that's the only way to justify voting is like if you like doing it and it feels good to you and it's you saying something, it's essentially the same as speech. Great, go ahead, do your thing. But, you know, your individual vote is not going to influence the outcome of the election. And so all the rest of those rationale should really fall away. Right at the top of Amash's feed today, he has a retweet, which is a small dialogue that I want to read to our podcast listeners, because I think it's pretty much every conversation I've been in recently about Amash's candidacy. Republican says, vote Trump or everyone dies. Democrat says, vote Biden or the world ends. Me, maybe I won't vote. Republicans and Democrats, you got to vote. It's your duty. Not voting is worse than voting for the candidate I hate. Me, okay, I'll vote for Justin Amash. Republicans and Democrats, you, it's written here as a blank, but I think we can assume there's some profanity there. Fine, don't vote. That's every conversation. That's going to be every conversation Justin Amash has until November, and it will be very frustrating for him, and it will show, as I think we started out, like it will show the bad brokenness of our duopoly and unfortunately, I do not. It does not change any of my priors about whether or not I will be going to the ballot box this fall.
It's going to be very frustrating for him, but it's also going to be frustrating for
me.
You, right?
It's going to be frustrating for me. That's what we really care about.
Nick, we wrote, and I feel like it's been a while since we've clicked off this bingo square. But one of the things that we wrote about in our book of 1,000 years ago was that it's hard for people in the moment to imagine something unimaginable, whether it's Black Swan event, getting SM Taliban for a debate, or just like some, we have recency bias. We think that last year is going to be next year always, or last election is going to be next election. I have become pessimistic about a lot of things, but also about the political climate for independent and third party candidates right now. But is it also possible, when you look at, you know, the massive size, the bailout and stimulus, the massive size of unemployment, the getting to be massive size of number of people who died, excess deaths, certainly New York City, but around the country. Do you think that that could be creating a political moment or set of possibilities that certainly my puny brain is unable to grapple with and therefore might be an opportunity for Justin Amash?
Yeah, I think so. And it's partly a question. I don't think the question to ask is Amash going to get, 30%? Is he actually going to challenge? It's what are the threshold levels for the major parties where they start to get scared about, a 5%, vote going to Justin Amash. And it doesn't seem at this point, it doesn't seem like the Green Party or there's no other third party candidate that's going to be out there, which I think is good for Amash. He's got, and he is, even more so than somebody like Gary Johnson or Bill Weld, because he's a sitting congressman and he's younger. He is vibrant and different. In the interview I did with him, I was trying to, through hand signals and what goad him into being more generationally angry. And, he did say that Joe Biden is just too old. He's like, he's not there anymore. And Donald Trump was never there. And I want to see that. But Amash is different, both because than most third party candidates, both because he's credible and he looks and sounds different than either of the two main rivals, who are, Statler and Waldorf at this point. I mean, who gives a shit about these guys? They're just dull, dumb people who are talking about stuff that, there should be an automatic escape hatch. If you invoke Esther Williams in a casual conversation, like Biden
okay,
did,
like,
I, and I know Esther
like
Williams
do
really well.
So my, I'm feeling, yeah, I'm feeling a,
no, but
attack.
I'm saying this is like, unless you are doing it while, wearing a hipster hat and a goatee and smoking some kind of weird pipe.
Complicated
it's
for you,
like,
Catherine.
If you're invoking Esther Williams unironically,
What if I'm wearing a bathing cap
president
with flowers on it?
That would... I would love that. And if you're about to do a water ballet,
tweet that kind of went around last week about somebody tweeted at Amash, like, you running in this important election and potentially stealing votes away from Biden is the epitome of white male entitlement. And he just tweeted back, like, I am literally the only non-white candidate anywhere.
Well, and hopefully, I mean, I hope he engages that kind of stuff, to kind of complicate all of these easy slags that people are throwing. Because, of course, Justin Amash is white if Middle Eastern people are white and they were kind of white up until a couple of years ago.
It's 17 kinds of hashtag
at,
problematic right there. Nicely done.
I'm with him.
No, but I mean, let's open it up. I mean, I come from, my mother's side of the family was not white probably until sometime after World War II, so it's like, let's have these conversations. We'll be better off. What I'm getting at, though, is that when the Democratic and Republican Party establishment start to get worried that Amash might take 3% or 5% of the vote, enough to potentially swing the election, one possibility, they'll try to destroy him. One other possibility is that they will start playing to the sensibility that they think he's going after. And that's when things will really change, because we're not going to get rid of two major parties, what those parties stand for can change a lot. And at this point, in a weird way, the coronavirus stuff is foregrounding the fact that the Democrats and the Republicans are kind of similar. You know, the stimulus bill, the CARES Act passed, and all of the spending is passed unanimously, essentially, in Congress. And so that means there's everybody who is against, you know, the massive shoveling of government money to Shake Shack and to Axios and to, you know, establishment places, you know, they want somebody to vote for, and it's going to be Amash. And that might end up having a real meaningful impact on the way that we talk about politics, but also how the major parties start to present.
Let's go to our near end of show Corona death count. No, I wanted to make sure we talk a little bit about coronavirus. And since we've been ticking off numbers, let's tick off a few and then go for a quick round of discussion about our personal lives and feelings. So we now have 68,000 deaths in the U.S., which is up from 55,000 last Monday. There's about 250,000 deaths worldwide. In the U.S., 1.2 million cases thereabouts, up from 1 million a week ago. It's 3.5 million worldwide. The curve seems to be flattening and plateauing-ish around the country, taken as a whole. But when you take New York City out, New York City's thankfully starting to finally go down. There's a lot of states that are still kind of going up. Texas is going up faster. There's a very good roundup to this morning from Elizabeth Nolan Brown at Reason, just kind of going through the various lockdown orders. Speaking of lockdowns, they continue to be protested. They continue to be popular. It's a very strange set of circumstances. There's been a bunch of protests around, but whenever it's polled, people seem to be kind of in favor of it. It was a particularly nice weekend in New York City, and I presume down in Washington as well. So just quickly, Nick, how did you break out of lockdown? What did you observe the humans doing? And how does that kind of pertain to how you look at what's going to happen going forward?
It was a beautiful day in New York City, and my girlfriend and I took MDMA and hung out in Central Park with a couple of people, and it was great.
Bless your heart.
It was one of the best days of my life.
Did you take off your shoes and run your toes through the grass and think about
love? I did not. There was a lot of that going on, but I chose not to do that. I didn't feel a need to, but it was fantastic. And seeing people in Central Park were observing social distancing, but there were more people out than I had seen in a long time. And then the city, as it got dark, the city shut down again. There were like very few cars and very few people out. I am a big believer in the idea that we have kind of lockdown fatigue, and it's going to become increasingly difficult to keep people indoors and away from each other. Matt, you referenced Huntington Beach earlier, and that's, I 30 years ago it was surf Nazis in Huntington Beach, and now it's just people on the beach, you know, and like, what are you going to do? You know, what are you going
to
do?
The answer to Huntington Beach, what are you going to do? The answer is riot. It's always riot. Quickly, Nick, did you mask or not mask?
Of course. I wear a mask when I go out. You know, and particularly in New York, I guess it's actually legally binding that when you go into stores or confined spaces, you need to be wearing a mask. If you're not around anybody, you don't have to. So, you know, I'm happy to observe those protocols, and most people are. I'm not fully convinced that that helps that much, sure. And I think we need to start figuring out ways to let people get out more and start to resume more normalcy in their lives.
Catherine, what were you dosing this weekend out in the grass?
Nothing, sadly. I did want to talk a little bit about the Central Park thing, because I think similar to the pictures of the Florida beaches, it's like a real Rorschach test at this point, what you see when you look at those images. Like, and I don't know whether this is a, you know, if it's political or if it's culture war or if it's just something more basic. But when I looked at those beach pictures, and also when I looked at these pictures that were going around of Central Park, to me, it was like, oh, people are doing their best. Like people are 6 feet apart. People have on masks. Like clearly they have little blanket islands that are separate from each other. To me, it was like a an image that showed people adapting to adverse circumstances and doing their best to protect each other while not making life not worth living. And the fact that some people saw that and some people looked at the same picture and saw like irresponsible monsters whose selfishness is going to end life as we know it, you know, it just shows how far apart we are on even a shared understanding of what good behavior looks like, in addition to knowing whether that type of those type of precautions are necessary. But my coronavirus meditations for this week are, as these numbers have come out and we've seen that so many of the deaths are in nursing homes and nursing facilities and elder care communities, I am selfishly, but also kind of on a broader social level, just thinking like, my God, I can't put my olds in a nursing home. Like, that's going to be a very, very, very hard thing to justify even 10 years from now, having seen what we've seen. And I, you know, my bias already was somewhat against that as a permanent solution, you know, compared with in-home care and mother-in-law suites and all kinds of other stuff like that. But the clarity of the data, at least right now, in terms of how dangerous those places are in a situation like this, is really causing me to think about and rethink my assumptions about what my future looks like, what my family's future looks like, because I think those just don't look like a very good option unless something very dramatic changes. And something very dramatic might change, right? Like, this is my whole jam, is like, we could figure out a hygiene protocol, we could staff those things with robots, we could, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of ways that we might make
robots,
make nursing,
mostly robots.
There's all kinds of ways we might make nursing facilities and nursing homes work better. But if we don't figure out a way to improve those, and I'm not super hopeful about innovation in a space that is heavily dominated by government regulation, government funding, that's going to go away. That thing is going to change and go away in the form that it currently exists for a lot of people. And I think that's like an undervalued or an underappreciated outcome of this, because we just don't have time and space to think about what happens 5 years or 10 years down the line. But that's what I started thinking about this week.
The nursing home issue is pretty real. I mean, my father-in-law got COVID-19 in a nursing facility where he was recovering temporarily, not someplace he was staying full time. And so he appeared to have mild symptoms, but not severe symptoms. It was difficult. We had an extended discussion, let's say, just to get him tested to begin with. And then after he was tested and found positive, they kept him for another 2 weeks and then discharged him without a test. So, of course, he got a test. We managed to get him a test, not in the facility, but afterwards, after he had been discharged. He was still positive, which meant that my wife and her sister, who had gone up to take care of him, were then stuck in a house with a COVID positive patient, which is pretty much, aside from maybe being in a nursing home yourself, pretty much the best way to get it. And that has meant that they've had to extend their stay and do basically self-quarantining, also quarantining within the house. It has been just in addition to kind of terrifying for various health reasons, just an absolute nightmare in terms of logistics, because, you know, he has a decent sized house, but it's an all open plan on the main floor, and he has trouble with stairs. And so it's just been very difficult, and it's really not clear what families should do. Should families leave their fathers, their grandparents in nursing homes? Should they get them out and then try to take care of them at home but risk infecting themselves? It's very, very difficult. There's all sorts of state regulations that are involved here that both direct nursing homes to do things that maybe they shouldn't be doing, or that are just designed to give nursing homes cover. And it really puts families in extremely difficult positions, and it has meant, again, everyone, he has mild symptoms. It looks like he's going to be okay. There's at this point no indication either my wife or her sister, who went up there to take care of him, have caught it themselves, although we don't know for certain. But it has meant that she, in the midst of a pandemic, lockdown situation, that she has been away from her home for about a month now, and it's not entirely clear when she's going to be able to come back. And the same goes for her sister. And it's just been, it has been logistically, as well as like, just frankly, kind of emotionally, fairly draining. And at the same time, it's also not clear, you know, what steps should have been taken, you know, along the line, certainly by us, to prevent this, you know, sort of as individuals. It's really a difficult situation to be in a lot of ways.
I have been talking about that, thinking about what should have been done, whether in terms of policy or personally. I have found myself on a kind of weird loop where it's all like one layer of complexity beyond what I can grasp. So even like thinking through, do I want my friends to come up positive or negative in their antibody tests? I can't figure out the answer to that question.
What does that mean, Matt? You're wishing that some of your friends will die?
No, that they had it and recovered.
They had it and they recovered so that we could all hang out on my patio and drink Palomas. It's hard to wrap my brain around a lot of these things. But here's my one recommendation, certainly for people who live in New York or in places where this applies. As we're sort of, you know, trying to figure out when do we get to break out and what can we do? And, you know, our situation's pretty good compared to most people's probably, in that we haven't known anyone to be, you know, to go through even what Peter and his family have gone through. We bought a car. We just like said, screw it, let's buy a car. And like, oh, and like,
God, so that you, man, could go after, to a, like a parking of- lot rave.
I'll totally
go to see this, or
yeah, the Germans, of course.
It's really great.
I'm sure it's
Matt, I thought you were like super anti-car. You made big declamations of car ownership after your car got stolen.
I enjoyed not having a car back when I lived in a city where taking the subway seemed like a good idea.
So like 6 weeks ago,
my wife went to get her antibody test, and the doctor said, "Oh yeah, I'm never going to ride the subway again." Which was kind of a sobering exercise. And
that sounds like an idiot doctor, Matt. I wouldn't trust the results.
Even thinking about, like, you know, we want to go to the beach. And the way to go to the beach is to hop on the subway that's 10 feet from my front door and take it to Coney Island. And like, and imagining doing it. Anyways, so from like, oh, what if we had a car, to buying one did not take more than a few hours, and the level of happiness that suddenly washed over us, or a sense of relief. I guess it's like it's similar to when you get the epidural injection when you're going through labor. Suddenly, the absence of a certain type of pain.
Bold analogy there, Matt.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've all been there, Matt.
I mean, when you're like dosing in Central Park, you know what I'm talking about. It turns out like a personal sense of freedom and latitude by point-to-point vehicular private ownership is pretty damn great sometimes.
Thanks. Thank you, Bob Poole.
Yeah, I do hope that, and I doubt this is going to happen because, you know, part of the sub-reading that I've been doing is all of these past pandemics that immediately disappear from cultural discussion. So there was a pandemic, a flu pandemic globally, an epidemic in the late 60s in America. 100,000 people died from it, and nobody remembers it. The one in 57, 58 also kind of washed over. The 1918 flu changed a variety of things in public health, but it was not remembered very well for a long time. I would love to see the medical establishment, the delivery of medicine, and things like elder care or, you know, nursing homes, really, if we had a serious think through of everything that has gone wrong so far, including testing. I mean, Peter, it's like, it's appalling that like your father-in-law is in a nursing home and has COVID-19.
Was in a nursing home.
Like, oh, yeah, well, yeah, he's not. But, you know, let's not test him because, you know, those tests are for people who really need it or something. We still haven't ramped up tests. We need to think through so much of this stuff, and I worry that we won't.
Let's go to our endo podcast. What the hell have you been consuming culturally during this endless quarantine lockdown? Catherine, you go first.
I have a somewhat serious recommendation and also a ridiculous one. My somewhat serious one is, as I've mentioned on this podcast before, I am a fan of the Anthropocene Reviewed podcast, which is John Green's pod, in which he just chooses random things in human life and reviews them. I finally got a chance to catch up on my listening, as I mentioned last week. And he mentioned in passing one of his books that I was not aware of, which was called An Abundance of Catherines. So obviously, I was like, I'm going to need to read that. It's a pretty good young adult novel about a young a prodigy, a teen prodigy who has dated 19 Catherines and is attempting to graph how love works. And I would say if you enjoyed a Russ Roberts's romance novels, perhaps you would enjoy this one as well. Russ Roberts romance novels, of course.
But you did enjoy Roberts' romance novels.
Russ Roberts romance novel, in particular, The Invisible Heart. And Abundance of Catherines is not unlike it in its tone and charm. But my real recommendation is YouTube videos that teach you how to cut hair, because I spent a good chunk of this weekend barbering my family. And I got to tell you, like, it is very satisfying. It is a great task for people who want to, like, impose order on disorder. People who are enemies of chaos, like myself. And
who have long, creepy death fingers.
Who have long, creepy death fingers, which are well suited to you know, the wielding the scissors. But I can now use the little clippers. I just recommend it. It feels like a skill that I acquired, and I have been skeptical of people that have been like, I'm going to use the coronavirus to acquire a new skill because, like, screw you. We're all just trying to keep it together here. This is not a moment for new skills. This is a moment for not drowning. But I accidentally acquired a new skill, and I'm pretty happy about it. So I will share a tutorial that I recommend on the recommendations page on this podcast at reason.com, as well as on our page that collects all of our recommendations, which exists, by the way, and you should go check it out. But there are a wide variety of them out there, and I would urge people who are going to do this themselves to either use the one that I am suggesting, which is the Hairdresser Reacts tutorial. This is a guy who became famous for watching videos of people giving themselves bad home hair treatments, and it's just... the gimmick of the videos is just his face going like, oh, honey, no, as people do terrible things. But he's like chosen to give back and teach people how to do it right. So that is my recommendation. But watch a bunch of them and then go to it. You too can learn to cut hair at home.
I have acquired no skills in this period of time, but I've acquired one of my new short handful of favorite directors, movie directors. Is now confirmed. It's Hayao Miyazaki, the Studio Ghibli Japanese guy. I mentioned last time we watched Spirited Away, which is tremendous. And then we watched another one this past week from 2013. It's the last one that he's done. It was supposed to be his retirement vehicle, but he came out of retirement and is making something now. But it's called The Wind Rises. Came out 2013. Was nominated for Academy Award. It's a fictional biopic of Yiro Horikoshi, who was a great Japanese airplane designer of the 1930s, because why not? That's a good topic. It is probably the most beautiful animated movie I've ever seen. It is unbelievably beautiful. Just skies, paintings, flowers, architecture. It's filled with zeros. It's filled with long silences, wind. It's a tragic love story. It's a meditation on the importance of creating beauty for beauty's sake, even if it's used for evil. It's just like blew my face clean off. It's an incredible movie. Go check it out. Their movies are hard to get. I watched it on DVD that we had acquired in France, so I saw it in French. So maybe I didn't understand it. That's why I liked it so much. But anyways, great movie. Nick, what did you make it to?
I watched the Waco miniseries that originally aired on Paramount Network in 2018, and then it was trending hot on Netflix over the past week or so. It's a fantastic, dark, just probing kind of recreation of the events of Waco, of the Branch Davidian showdown. It's like Tiger King, and I mean this kind of lightly, but not. But again, you know, you seek out things that somehow mirror what you're going through. It's a lockdown drama. And it is a fantastic exploration of how David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, and David Koresh was not a good person. You know, he was messed up, and he was charismatic, and he brought people together in a way that they ended up dying. But it is such a fantastically deep and nuanced critique of the government response, so the ATF as well as the FBI and Janet Reno and the Department of Justice. And it is really, really a powerful revisiting of one of the worst chapters in, you know, recent American history. And, you know, I don't know where Peter and Catherine were in 1993 in terms of this kind of stuff, Matt, and you might have been out of the country by then. Yeah, it's good to revisit because it is a particular type of government overreaction and hysterical response where they create the very damage that they seek to obviate. And that's a lesson that is always worth thinking about. And I think it's particularly now in a less kind of, I was going to say extreme way, that's not quite right, but in a less obvious way where we have the, you know, for a variety of reasons, government at all levels just taking over more and more parts of our everyday life. It's a sobering, wonderful, incredibly well done thing, which was badly reviewed when it came out in 2018 because everybody was like, you know, they're kind of tough on, you know, on the FBI and the ATF, and it, which is also kind of staggering because this is David Koresh could be a horrible human being, and he's not the one who killed the people in the Waco compound or in Mount Carmel.
Suderman, so. Take us home.
This week I read two novels about lives and societies irrevocably changed by great loss. The first was The Glass Hotel. It's the brand new novel by Emily St. John Mandel, who Catherine mentioned her previous novel, Station 11, on a couple of weeks ago. Station 11 was about a pandemic that kills most of everyone, and then about a group of people, specifically a sort of traveling Shakespeare troupe and orchestra that learn to sort of survive and exist in the post-pandemic world. But it also takes place before the pandemic happens and sort of, before people die, and there's just sort of sense of time shifting. And that novel is about loss and about regret and about how big social changes affect people and affect their psyches. And her new novel is not quite sort of, it's not about quite as great a loss or sort of quite as totalizing a loss, but it's about the collapse of a Ponzi scheme during the Great Recession that is closely based on the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. And so what you meet several characters who are entangled in this one way or the other, including the Madoff stand-in and his young, she literally calls herself, so I'm not using this derogatorily, she calls herself a trophy wife, except part of the gag is, or part of the gimmick is, everybody thinks they're married, but they're not. And so, of course, it is a fake marriage because if he had actually been married to her, that would have implicated her if he ever got caught, which he does sort of around the middle of the novel. And so then the novel takes place in this sort of zone of before and after. People who have lost everything, all of their savings in this, the Madoff guy who ends up in jail, his young wife who had been granted entry into what she calls the world or the country of money, of sort of excess, incredible wealth. And then, of course, what their lives look like afterwards. And it's this really, really beautiful and haunting novel about regret and loss and the ways you sort of try to escape The memories of your old life when you have lost it, when it was a good thing, when a wonderful thing that you no longer have and can't ever have anymore. And then I read another novel that is ended up being weirdly thematically similar, despite being completely different tonally and in time. Tunnel in the Sky by Robert Heinlein. It is a 1955 short, like YA boys adventure novel, except it's not just a YA boys adventure novel. It's really a book about the theory of government. And so, which is in some ways fairly common for Heinlein, but it's about a group of students, sort of, let's say, late high school or so, who go on a survival test, except instead of being called back at the end of their 2 weeks or whatever from the planet that they have been basically teleported to, the sort of wild place, the callback never comes. And they eventually realize this. And what do? They start rebuilding a society. And at first it's like, well, we need food and shelter and there's four of us, right? First there's one guy and then there's two people and then there's four people. And it's just like, let's find a cave. Okay, now we've got a cave. Let's figure out a way to hunt regularly. Let's, and cook food. Let's find salt that will allow us to cure. Like, okay, but then we're going to collect more people. And what are we going to do with more people? We've got to find resources and build for them. And first we've got to do basic sustenance stuff. We've got to build shelter and security and sort of figure things out. But eventually what we're going to have to do, they realize, is form a government. And it is a book about process and about creating good government
the word
is a process.
Process more lovingly than Peter Suderman.
But it's a book about how good governments are good processes for, on the one hand, making decisions that need to be made, and on the other hand, creating systems where people can disagree productively without killing each other and continuing to do the things that need to be done. And it's this great, right? Like these books kind of really balance each other out, because one is so sort of infused with regret and loss and just this sense that after you've lost everything, what you really want to do is escape, which I think is a feeling that people have had recently. And the other one is this very hopeful book about how when you've lost everything and been put in an unknown world unexpectedly with no warning, what you do is you take stock of the resources you have, you band together with other people, and you rebuild something that is imperfect, that doesn't always work as well as you want it to, but is functional, reminds you of the old world, carries on, right? They have like these discussions about the Constitution, about the Bill of Rights, and whether they're going to adopt the old one. And it's like kind of heartening. And at the end, of course, at the very end of it, the people, they actually come back after like years and years. And what happens is the guy who is our main character here doesn't want to leave because he built something for himself. He built his own world. And there is this, it's really a kind of, it's a smart and fun adventure book that is also about what happens when the world is taken away from you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Catch you next week. Go to Reason.com podcasts for all your podcast loveliness at Reason. Goodbye.